Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness. And that means that we're in a time of transition. We're at a time where we are becoming more fully alive to who we are, spiritually, mentally, emotionally. And tonight's guest very much deals with that. He's the author of You Are More Than That, A Guide to Embracing the Spiritual Being Within and Becoming Fully Human, just the very things I love talking about on this program. He's Dr. Raj Juneja, and thank you, Dr. Raj, for being with us tonight.
Alan, thank you so much for having me.
I mean, everything you talk about in your new book is something that I feel I'm dedicated to for myself and for the programs I do on radio and television. And let's just kind of give an overview of what you say of combining these spiritual beings with becoming fully human. How do you sort of equate the two and unify those two concepts?
Well, you know, actually, so the way I ultimately looked at it was I was always trying to understand this idea that we are a reflection of perfection. But then I was always trying to make sense of that with, well, I have these problems. I have these challenges. How can I be perfect? And ultimately, what I realized was that, you know, really, we're talking about two things here. One, we're talking about our human experience. And then two, we're talking about our spirit and consciousness itself. And so it is in the human, it's in my human form. Of course, I have problems, I have challenges, I figure out the solutions, etc. But in my spirit, I am whole, I am complete, that, you know, we're not broken. So many people, I've sat with thousands of people, and so many people, you know, they have work problems, love problems, you know, play problems and trouble in relationships, which often leads to addiction. But so many are lost on that human side and really not connected to this innate perfection that we are born with and that is with us through our entire life.
Well, but I do understand what you're saying, but how, okay, let's say, of course, we're perfect, but then how do you get these emotional problems or situations that make us feel less than perfect integrated into this consciousness of perfection? The two, I don't quite see the bridge there yet.
Yeah, so let's say somebody who, for example, let's say he's having a divorce, right? So they're having relationship problems, they end up in, and they're going to separate for whatever reasons. Now, often, that person will see this as a reflection of themselves. Yes, now they showed up a certain way. Of course, that led to possible certain problems. And, you know, relationships are always bilateral. So both people participated in that process. However, even though they had, you know, participated in this process, it doesn't mean that they are not worthy beings. So that's where I separated out in my mind that I said, you know, spiritually we are worthy. Spiritually we are whole. If we think about it, every point in space of, you know, that is in existence in this entire universe, everything is expressed and it's a part of this whole consciousness, God consciousness. So, you know, it's not something that I really related to our human circumstances. That was the mistake I felt that people were making. Somebody loses a job. They say, oh, now I'm not worthy. How many people lost money in the stock market and ended up, you know, ending their life? Because they're so overly identified with their human existence.
Well, but okay, so if we're not, how do we overcome that? I mean, we are humans. I don't care how many people say we're spiritual beings having a human experience, but yeah. We are still human and we have those emotional situation. I mean I know what you're saying, but I still have feelings that I feel are less than perfect, let's say.
Right. Now see, even if you have feelings or I have feelings that are less than perfect, does it mean we're less worthy? right?
But wait, let me just ask you, if my worth is my feeling of worth is based on the emotional response that I get in the world, do people love me, or I'm feeling sad or depressed, I mean, and I'm not feeling worthy, I know on another level, of course, we are worthy because we're here and all that, but how do I let those other emotional feelings not rule me?
I think that's a great question. And really what we're now talking about is our story. You know, we all have a story. You know, I grew up in India. I moved here when I was 5. But, you know, sometimes I think, who would I be if I would have grown up in India? You know, would I be doing what I do? I don't know. Probably not. You know, I probably would be, you know, in a different reality.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying there then is it's in our story that often our suffering lives. Because actually, I have a great analogy for this. You think about how a guitar string vibrates. What makes it vibrate at the frequency it does? Well, the answer is the points of attachment to the guitar. So think about what makes us vibrate the way we vibrate. It's how we're attached to our story. So it's the story that has some parts that, yes, are very accurate, and then other interpretations that were not, right? So let me give you an example of that. So when I was a young kid, you know, when we moved here to the United States, my father essentially, you know, they came from a very difficult, you know, background, not, you know, never went to college, etc. And so my father said to me when I was very young, he said, become someone. And what I heard that, what I translated that to be was, oh, I'm an empty glass. I am currently no one and I have to become someone. Now, that's not what he was saying. But that's what I took in.
And how did that make you feel, though?
Well, number one, it made me feel that I wasn't enough, right? So I had to do something externally to become enough. Hence, I said, okay, well, I'll go to med school, right? I'll become a doctor. That sounds like something that would be worthy and worth-oriented. And, you know, make a long story short, Alan, you know, Lincoln Center, you know, sunny, beautiful day, graduation day, everybody's there, and it hit me like a ton of bricks, cap and gown. I was ready to walk into the hall. I didn't feel any different. I said, what? What's going on here? I thought this was supposed to give me that sense of self-worth and self-esteem. And that was really quite a turning point in my life. That is the moment I said, aha, something else is going on. And, you know, getting back to your question, so when we're suffering and, you know, and when we're in that pain, it can feel very real. In fact, it does feel real. What we have to realize, though, is that some of the pain, some of the suffering can be based on false beliefs from the past. And that's why I go back to the story. So we have to understand what parts of the story were accurate and what parts of the story were not.
Well, but whether they're accurate or not, we have our feelings and our reactions. So let's say you felt your father was judging you, right? And you have that reaction about it. The reaction is based on you living in the past is what you're saying, right?
Right. That's what I'm saying. So, so for that example, right. So I took that to mean, oh, I'm currently no one. I'm currently not worthy. Now that led to, let's say, down, you know, having a depressed mood at times, but that depressed mood was not based on, you know, absolute truth, because in absolute truth, I am worthy, but it was based on a false belief that I had to, you know, get this worthiness from the outside. And so I had to understand that part of my story to loosen those chains, to loosen what was holding me back.
Oh, so let's go into that detail. So you felt unworthy, you felt judged by your father, then you had to understand what exactly to let go of that story.
Well, one, I had to understand that it wasn't true, that, you know, that this external drive, this, you know, putting up, you know, diploma after diploma, you know, I've done 3 fellowships, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, to realize it cannot go come from the outside. This is something that is inherently a birthright, so to speak.
Yeah, but how did you get that? I mean, you did all these things to prove you were worthy.
Yes.
And then the worth didn't come because you got all those diplomas. How did the worth come to you that you were worthy of your spiritual essence or whatever you want to call that?
Right. So ultimately what I had to get to was the root cause. I had to get to what was the belief that was holding this false belief of me not being worthy in place.
And so, what was that root cause? I'm sorry, you can say that. Yes.
No, that's okay. So the root cause actually was, you know, a number of, you know, first of all, it was that initial false belief that I had to somehow get it from the outside.
Right.
That was, and then, of course, as I was growing up and developing, you know, I would attempt to get it from the outside, but because it could never come from the outside, it kept reinforcing that I wasn't worthy because I kept looking for it from the outside.
Right, and it was never coming, and you got all those diplomas and degrees and doctors and ships and you... So... But you realize that people are still in that situation. Many people are,
yes.
Most people are thinking, you know, this relationship will make me feel worthy, or making a lot of money will make me feel worthy, or
that's right.
Being famous will, whatever.
That's right.
Famous might make me feel worthy, but anyway, it's okay. No, but you know, a lot of people are in that situation.
That's right.
And most of the world. So what do you do, really? I'm trying to understand the actual pathway.
Process.
Yeah, the process. Yes, yes.
So I think the number one, so really we're talking about what, you know, a problem, and then we're talking about a solution. And I think in order to get to the root cause, first of all, we have to be able to take a step back and really start asking ourselves questions, you know, especially about where we tend to get triggered. You know, so it's this first step of when do I react? What do I react to? It's this, you know, and I think many of your listeners and you know, your audience are very, you know, I imagine are already thinking along these lines of new realities, right? So they're already looking for their, you know, self-limiting aspects. And what I really strongly, strongly believe in is that our self-limiting aspects are really within our belief systems. So we have to start looking at our belief systems. Now that can be, you know, one could do it with a therapist, or one can do it really in journaling. There are obviously lots of, you know, a lot of the people that you interview talk about this self-reflective process, meditation, but to start going within and to start also paying attention to what our minds show us, right?
Well, how do we know what our minds show? It's like we're like a fish in water. It's our emotional realities is the reality we live in. How do we get to reflect that?
I'm just
going very basic because I want people to really get that understanding of self, even though, yes, I've covered it on many programs, but I think you got something really key in understanding who we are on a very fundamental level.
Right. Now, okay, so with that, let me also say then, we have to take one step back before we say, you know, go into that. And that what we have to do is we also have to have a clear model of the mind. And a good analogy for this is the iceberg. You know, what you see above the water is only 5 or 10%. Majority of that iceberg is below water. So we have to be able to now start thinking that the thoughts that are consciously in my mind are not all of the thoughts that are in my head, so to speak. That there's a lot going on that I'm not aware of, right? So then we can say, all right, let me go back and think of this as a, you know, different chapters of the same book. And this is the story of your life. And, you know, you're going to now, we can go back and start revisiting, you know, what was my childhood like? What were some of the, you know, key events of that period? What were some of the key events of my adult life? And I would say the first step is to start thinking about what is my theme where I end up not getting what I want in my life, the results I'm talking about. You know, we all have a theme that can... The people end up kind of being in a you know, they'll leave one relationship and they'll go to the next one. Surprise, surprise, you know, it's a different person, similar personality. You know, that type of a theme. Or maybe some people have a theme particularly with their work life. Where is it that people tend to, first of all, get hung up, right? Where are they having problems? That actually will direct them into saying, okay, where do I want to focus? All right, so maybe it's trouble in relationship, right? So let me think about that. I'm having trouble with my spouse. All right. Well, we're having, you know, difficulty communicating. Well, where is it that we tend to get hung up? Now, again, we have to keep in mind that now we have two people coming together. Now there's two different stories coming together, but I have to individually look at what am I bringing to the table, right?
Yeah.
And in general, since we're on this relationship piece, I'll continue with that. And obviously, you know, many people are in relationships. Usually what we'll find in a couple is that there's some unfulfilled need, that there's some primary unfulfilled need for that person, right?
Right.
And what we need to say is, all right, I wish he or she were more or less what? Blank. Now, I'll give you an example. So I have a couple in treatment with me. The woman, her father left at a very young age from the household. So she always wanted to be with a man who was going to be present, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who does she end up marrying? She picks a guy who works like 14 hours a day, right? So he's not really around a whole lot. So one thing about the mind that we have to understand in relationships is the mind recreates the conflict in hopes of a different outcome.
Right. That happens all the time with relationships. Everyone marries the same person they just divorced.
And that's right. That's right.
Yes.
So what has to happen is both individuals have to become aware of what is this unresolved need for the other person. Otherwise, they're going to continue to recreate it. And far as talking about their recreative piece, we'll continue to recreate, you know, other parts of our relationship in other, you know, work areas of our life, for example.
Mm.
So maybe if somebody had an abrasive, you know, primary experience when they were younger, they'll choose, believe it or not, abrasive people to go into business with.
Right. So how do you get out of that cycle, that pattern?
First of all, you have to recognize that there's a pattern, right? So I had to first recognize that, you know, I'm doing all these external things and none of them are particularly giving me that thing I'm looking for, right? Or in my relationships in my 20s, I would pick a certain type of, you know, person to get involved with, and I would then get very frustrated that how could this be? I just left this relationship and now I've... Go ahead.
No, I know that because I tend to kind of go and pick the similar relationships because I'm sure it has to do with my upbringing and I'm aware of it. So I'm aware of it, but yet it seems like it's a pattern for me, even though I'm aware. So I'm understanding what I'm doing, but I'm still doing it.
Right. So, first of all, we have to, once we become aware of our pattern, right? So
yeah.
We become aware of our theme, then... When we are, say, for example, when you run into somebody and you say, I'm kind of interested in that person. I'd like to get to know that person more. Well, then caution, caution, because if you're overly drawn to that person, what that means or what that suggests is that you are headed for another reset.
Well, aren't you usually going for people you're drawn to, though? I mean,
Exactly. That's exactly it. We are drawn to people who will actually help us recreate it. So if we can kind of bypass that, and if you think about it, sometimes, you know, when you meet somebody through a friend, it might not be somebody that you would have actually gone up to or talked to or been interested in to get to know. But because it came through this other channel, and initially you're like, oh, okay, there wasn't that big of a pull. But the more you get to know that person, things start shifting. You're like, oh, this person's a little different.
Wait, so you're saying don't immediately run towards the person you're first attracted to? That's hard to do.
I'll tell you, Alan, it's hilarious. It's funny on one hand, but Now I know if the bells and whistles start going off for me, warning, I know that more than likely is going to result in a similar situation for me that I've experienced in the past.
Really? Wait, let me just take that in. I think that changes my whole strategy. No, really. Okay, I get it. But I think I get it. So you just let those bells and whistles go off and you don't act on it or react to it, you're saying.
That's right. So you don't run with it. You know, don't be moved. You know, sometimes people are, well, we moved in together after 6 weeks.
That's like, right. You know, what's wrong with that?
You know. Well, you know what? You're going to find out real quick, right? There's some pros, there's some upsides to it. But of course, I think the cons list is there as well.
Right. You know, they talk about fires that burn up quickly and die out fast. You know?
That's right. And you know, and actually really, really another good analogy that demonstrates this is the following. Think about it. If you were going to be, you were going to produce a Broadway show and you were going to do the scripts and you were the lighting, the costumes, everything. And then there's a part in it for Ellen. And there's a part in it for your perfect idealized mate, right?
Right.
But guess who wrote the part? You did. So when you are unconsciously looking for somebody who will fill all of the good stuff of that part and all of the recreative negative stuff that your mind wants to attempt to heal. Because, right, so say going back to that woman who wanted a man that was going to be around.
Right.
So now if that man can get rid of his second business and make himself more available, now she's healing, right?
Yes, now, exactly.
That's it. It never happens.
Hardly ever happens. But that's what she is craving.
That's right. Know? So we have to become aware of the source and then how to fulfill that. So, you know, that need for ourselves.
So how do we, if we're wanting to heal, like in that woman's case, her father or the relationship with her father, then
yes.
How does she ultimately heal it? Because she's looking to heal it and, you know.
Well, one is I think she is, first of all, has to be able to separate out what belongs to her and her husband and what belongs between her and her father. Because a lot of times what will happen is, you know, one doesn't even realize they're projecting, you know, one right onto the next, you know what I mean? And maybe the father drove by and he didn't stop by. And now, you know, she's in reaction to that. And the husband comes home and he gets the brunt of this,
right? Right. So you have to be aware, but still we're emotional creatures before we're spiritual, before we're even physical, I think.
Yes.
We're emotional. And
That's right.
And so it takes a self-aware, it takes a lot of practice, but, you know, most people are driven by their emotions. And, well, how do you eventually heal that is, I guess, what I want to know.
Well, that's, you know, I think that's a perfect next question, which is you're saying, yes, we are primarily emotionally driven. And so, again, that's why I go back to first we have to identify where am I particularly reactive? Where are my buttons?
Right.
Those buttons, once you identify, you know, your own buttons, then you can trace them back to the source.
So that's a little, that says, hey, some sophistication to be aware, instead of just reacting, you're aware of your reaction. That's like a whole level of self-reflection that is not necessarily happening to a lot of people, right?
Well, I'd say that's right. Most people are just reacting, you know, and don't even realize that they're always in this reactive mode. And actually, I'll tell you, there's a very powerful tool, and it's a very simple tool. And so number one, when somebody finds themselves upset, sad, irritated, whatever mood state, to ask themselves, number one tool, am I in reaction? Very simple question. Am I in reaction? And what will happen is one will get a yes or a no. Usually there's always a reactive piece. So question number two, what am I in reaction to? What happened, right? So am I in reaction? What am I in reaction to? And now what the person has started doing is they are building that very self-awareness that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what will eventually happen is they will catch them after they're in reaction, and they'll catch themselves after they've already launched off, and then closer and closer to launch off. But then there comes a point where you just get proficient at this. You get better at it.
Right.
And you won't react. And so it's before. You'll feel the feeling, and but you won't act on the feeling. So many times, for example, say if somebody walks into my office and slams the door, mm-hmm. I could react to that, or I could think to myself, I wonder why this person just slammed the door.
Right. Well, you're a little more aware, I assume, than the other people. But if people are in reaction,
yes,
and this gets into the other part of, I think, what you deal with, addiction, people become addicted to those feelings. It's actually a chemical in the body, Candace Pert, the molecules of emotion. Our
yes.
emotions become chemical addictions. I mean, even... our everyday external addictions. Like, I have a friend who smoked cigarettes and she quit for a while, and then she went back because she got upset about something or something happened. And, you know, I think her body was just craving those chemicals that make her feel a certain way when she smokes cigarettes. So how do you get beyond, how do you conquer your addictions, as you talk about, with this level of awareness?
Right. So there's really two aspects there. We always want to be thinking about biology, nature, and the environment, nurture, right? And it's always both. It's always nature and nurture. It's always both. And listen, some people just have, you know, a greater predisposition to developing, you know, addiction problems. Now, so there are the hard addictions. I mean, when I'm saying hard, I mean cocaine, opiates, alcohol, right. You know, all of those. And then there are, and you know, we won't really see any journal articles on, say, addiction to frustration. You know what I mean?
Right.
But people get very comfortable, and I think this is what you're talking
about.
Or to.
Anger or sadness. People
yes.
are addicted to those simple
yes.
emotions.
Yes. Yes. They get very, very addicted to emotional states.
Yes. I agree. And I know people, you know, they're just looking for a reason to be angry, and it'll be anything, or to be sad, or to be whatever they are.
That's right.
So, yes, I agree with you. Absolutely.
And, you know, and so I have somebody I'm working with right now, and he's been depressed for so many years. And we've talked about a number of, I believe, in alternative and complementary treatments, you know. And in fact, I did, you know, another fellowship on that. And I make suggestions of maybe some nutraceuticals and maybe some other aspects. But I tell you, he's so comfortable in his depression, it makes him anxious to think about, well, if he wasn't depressed.
Exactly. He's addicted to the chemicals of depression.
That's
His
right.
body has gotten used to that. And if he's not depressed, he's not going to feel good.
Right.
Whatever he feels.
In its odd kind of way. He's not going to feel comfortable. Right?
Yeah, he's not going to feel what he normally feels of what he identifies self to be.
That's right. Even though he very much craves a better mood.
So how do you deal with – and so that can then be true of chemical addictions, cigarette, alcohol, any kind of yes. Feeling that we – I mean, actually, I think in cigarettes it's not so much – well, it is a chemical thing, but it's also the action.
Sure. All of the behavioral pieces.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, when we're talking about things like, you know, again, the opiates, heroin, you know, we're seeing a huge epidemic of opiate-related overdoses. In fact, you know, right now, the CDC, Center for Disease Control, is estimating that more people will die from opiate-related overdoses than motor vehicle accidents.
Wait, these are legal drugs or illegal drugs?
Well, both. Both the, you know, the prescription painkillers that people are, as well as, unfortunately, what happens is because those have such a high street cost, many people will switch to heroin because it's much cheaper.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Really, I didn't realize there was such an epidemic of drugs still happening. I guess it is, but
I'll tell you, in 17 states right now, Alan, more people die, and including New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, more people die from opiate-related overdoses than motor vehicle fatalities.
Wow! So, what can we do to help all these people on all level of emotional, drug addiction, right? If they're emotional or drug related, what's, is there a secret? Is there a key? What do you do?
Well, I tell you, the first secret and the only main, the main thing that one has to do is they got to get into treatment. You got to get into some process of understanding the addiction and understanding what is it that they're self-medicating psychologically.
Well, I mean, we can talk about getting into a program, but let's talk as much as we can right here for whoever's listening with what they can do just with themselves.
Well, I'd say the first question that always comes to mind is to think about when we're using any substance or any of these types of behaviors. Say it's addictive behavior towards work, and the guys or gals working 20 hours a day.
Right.
Whatever it might be, what are they running away from? Question number one, what am I avoiding?
So if someone's smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol, then there's an emotion they don't want to feel. Is that what you're saying?
More than likely, like think about somebody who comes home, and if they have that two glasses of wine and they were anxious and unhappy about something that might have happened in the morning with their partner or spouse, now are they likely to talk about it after two or three glasses of wine? Not really. They're going to be a little bit, go ahead.
But I'm just curious. What if it was an addiction that started years ago and those situations have revolved, but then the body is still craving those chemicals? If it's not always to, maybe it is always to suppress something, but what if it's just an automatic reflex?
Right. But that goes to the second area of the brain that's involved, which is the frontal cortex, which is our executive decision-making process, right? Because one thing that happens, and especially the hard addictions, is that the brakes get lost, so people have a difficult time saying no, even though they know they shouldn't be stopping by the liquor store, stopping by wherever they're stopping by, to get their particular drug of choice.
How do you change that? How do you actually go into the brain and rewire it?
Well, that is number one, it can be done, right? Talk therapy. Again, it goes back to this story, Alan. It goes back to, you have to understand, when did I start using drugs? What was I using drugs for? Oh, okay. I was using it to fit in. I was using it to feel accepted. All right. And then, it was helping me manage my anxiety. It was helping me push away feelings that I didn't feel like I was enough or I was worthy.
But I get that. But I also think I hear what you're saying. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, is that if we see ourselves as spiritual beings observing our cravings even,
yes,
we can sit and watch, okay, the body's craving this cigarette or this drink, but I'm not the body. I can observe it. Then I don't have to feed the addiction.
Yes, exactly. That you don't have to feed the addiction, and that when you have that level of awareness, when we can take that step back in our own mind and see that it's the spirit looking out, it's this body is having this awareness, then we can see my spirit is whole and complete. My body has this thing going on, but this has nothing to do with my innate perfection.
I think that is really the crux of your book, in a way, when you talk about the guide to embracing the spiritual being within and becoming fully human. It's that awareness that we're not the body, we're greater than the body, as a spiritual teacher I had used to say, Doesn't mean you should starve yourself or deny yourself, but, that has also been a tradition of doing that in order to get to be spiritual, but I don't think it works any. I don't think we have to suffer,
That's right. But in much of this suffering is happening because people say, this, and this happened to me, or I have this addiction and now I'm a piece of because I have this addiction. And I say, no, your body has this addiction. You're having this experience in your human life, but you're not, unworthy. You are a whole being sitting right here having this experience in this body. And so, but let's talk about where you are struggling with this addiction that you're experiencing right now.
So I think that's such a key point. If we really can get to that, let's call it a spiritual place of observing our reality, our internal environment, if we see this craving for something, for drugs, and if we just be with the craving without feeding it, it will lessen, won't it? Have you worked with that in a way?
Yeah, that's right. Usually the craving will come and then it'll go. It passes. But usually people are not in this, you know, let me take a step back and observe and try to understand where, you know, what happened today that I'm having this craving. You know, something triggered it, right? So it's not just, remember, the environment is always interacting with this chemistry in the body. So something triggered it in the environment. And now, but if we can take a step back and think about it, what happened? Am I in reaction to something? Even when you're having a craving, am I in reaction? Oh, I am in reaction. This was really upsetting me. And now I want to, you know, self-medicate. You know, so it gives the opportunity to understand that craving, and then when with understanding and insight, it resolves.
Mm-hmm. So how do we help people get to that level of self-awareness? Is there a process in doing that?
I'd say number one, and you know, I think you're obviously on this journey, and many of the people that are on New Realities, I would imagine, are already looking. So, you know, many people are not looking, you know. So the first step is to start looking for, you know, where are the problems in my life? What's causing me stress? You know, I was recently at the American Psychiatric Association, our annual meeting, and I was speaking to this woman, Elizabeth Blackburn, and she recently won the Nobel Prize. And, you know, she showed this so elegantly and so wonderfully. And the bottom line of her findings was that psychological stress destabilizes our DNA such that the DNA then starts getting more into these disease processes. And she won the Nobel Prize for that. So this psychological stress, so we have to identify what is causing us stress in our life. You know, and that stress then, you know, maybe leading to depression, loneliness, you know, addiction, addictive behaviors. And then we have to start looking for the solution and the root cause, starting to become aware of when we're, where are we reactive, you know, and starting to understand that we are not our story. Now, again, I'm sure you've heard that dozens of times and many of your listeners have heard that. But it was really only recently over the last couple of years, I finally got that piece. I've heard it for a long time, but I finally got it because I started really reconnecting with that wholeness and that self-worth that was always there spiritually. And the more I connect with it in meditation, the more I connect with it with keeping my word, the more I connect with it with living a purposeful life, that, you know, the less these external, you know, circumstances, when they don't go a particular way, they don't rock my world. I say, okay, you know, this was also in divine order.
So that's what you mean by the title of your book, You're More Than That? It means that you're more than your story.
That's right. We are more than our story. We are more than just a human being, and we are more than just a spiritual being. This is, in so many people trap themselves with the labels. I'm an addict. I am this, I am that, you know, I am a doctor. You know, now I really keep mindful of that and say, you know, my training is as a physician. You know, I am, you know, instead of limiting ourselves with these labels, why don't we actually open it up? And actually, you are more than that. And that's where that title comes from.
I see. So you do work a lot then with this idea of romantic relationships.
Oh, yes, right? Yes. And it's one of my favorite areas to work.
Is it? Maybe you can help me. No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's good advice to probably not run towards the person that sets off the bells and whistles, because that is like some unconscious pull.
Yes.
So how then, but that's how do you then know who, because that's usually what drives people. How do you then know who to be drawn to, or who your partner would be? You want someone who you're going to be pulled towards. I mean,
right. So you do. So and
how do you balance that? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think first of all, we know, you know, number one, that we take it slow. And what I mean by that is often, you know, many times people will start, you know, into getting into a physical relationship quite early. you know? And so in the book, I talk about this 90-day rule that I learned in a leadership seminar. You know, what they had it, you know, because obviously when you go through any kind of work experience together, people get close, you know? So, but I thought, you know, this is a really good rule or guide, really, to get to know the other person, you know, before, you know, we have a false experience with them. Remember, when we first meet somebody, we're looking almost like through a peephole, you know, or a peeking hole through the door. We don't see the whole person. Right. You know, that, in fact, the two things that drive, you know, kind of a romantic kind of connection is one, idealization of the other person, and two, the mystery. Right. This is why in the beginning, when we meet somebody, we say, oh, you know, I love it when he does that, or I love it when she does that, right. You know,
until you hate when she does that.
Exactly. 6 or 8 weeks, 10 weeks later, you're like, I can't stand it when she does that.
Exactly. The honeymoon's over after that. Right.
That's right. That's right. But unfortunately, many people are already physically involved by this point. Mm-hmm. Now that's brought on a whole nother element of connection. And, you know, so now this thing can get drawn out into 3 months, 6 months, 6 years.
Right. There's that famous New Yorker cartoon. The girl says to the guy, I knew it wasn't going to work out. I just didn't know it was going to work out for this long. You
know? That's right. That's right. So it's so taking our time, you know, and actually when the bells and whistles are going off, I hate to say this, but it's probably not it, you know, probably, it's not impossible.
No, I know, but you take your time, and I do believe in love at first sight, maybe that's my problem, but you take your time, you get to know that person, and then do the bells and whistles ever go off?
Well, surprisingly, so see, what happens is now when I can understand, well, what are your needs, and when the other person understands what your needs are, and when you understand what the other person's needs are, and you start coming from that place, oh, that person will feel loved like never before.
Oh, let me take that in. So
yes.
When you get to know the person.
Yes.
And you understand their needs and feelings.
Yes.
And you start to vibrate at those levels in a real way as opposed to this projection way.
Yes.
Then you can really start to feel closer to that person, right?
That's right. That's right. You'll have a deeper experience of love. Now, keep in mind, this might be quite different than all of the, you know, the real kinds of roller coaster ups and downs and those recreative, conflict-driven relationships. This might be actually much more stable and a much deeper level of love than you've ever experienced before.
Right. But then things still come up in relationships. At some point, you're going to project the past onto that person, perhaps. I mean, but it seems
Yes. And then that's the ongoing work of being in a relationship. It reminds me of that other, you know, that old saying that, you know, relationship is, you know, it's not a noun, it's a verb. You know, we don't do it, we're in it, you know.
Right. It's like that T-shirt I saw. Marriage is not a word, it's a sentence.
That's it. That's it. And it is a lot of work. Let's be honest. You know, relationships are, but they're very fruitful in many ways, and they have their challenges.
Well, we need relationships. We need to, there's a basic human need to connect with other humans. And how would you say then you started to say it, how to really have a healthy, clear, beautiful relationship with another person. What's like some of the keys to that?
Well, I'd say, first of all, you know, try to pick someone who's psychologically minded, you know,
right.
You know, in the sense of, because these issues are going to come up. And if you're with somebody who's psychologically minded, boy, is it easier.
See someone who's aware of their feeling, who has some self-awareness there.
Some self-awareness, some curiosity. Can, you know, maybe on the second or third date, you bring up, you know, the mind, or maybe some, hey, would you ever go to, you know, you probably don't want to do this on date number one. You probably don't want to bring it up. But, you know, by the third or fourth date, a month in, you can say, hey, you know, if we did, you know, end up dating and, you know, and wanted to find a deeper layer of connection, would you be open to going to a couples therapist, you know, working? Maybe, you know, right away, you'll find out if they're open to it or not. You have to be careful about believing them, you know. Again, it's early on.
I wouldn't say that on the first day, but I would tune in and see if that person had some level of self-awareness, you know.
That's right.
You know, the question is a silly question comes up. It's like, who are all those unconscious people going to date then, you know? But I guess that's not my problem.
Well, you know, they're dating each other, and unfortunately, is, you know, there's a lot of unhappy people out there. Listen, you have 40-50% getting divorced. Think about the other 40-50%. You know, I'd say probably a majority of them, many people are just kind of in it. You know, they're not necessarily, you know, in a joyful state, you know?
Right.
And so what are we talking? 10%, 15% of people are actually in a fulfilling relationship, you know? And so I think without this kind of self-reflection, self-awareness, social awareness, I think reaching that level of joy is very difficult.
Right. And you also talk about this purpose-filled highway. So it's
yes.
Fulfillment in your relationship. That's key. Fulfillment in your own self-worth. And then you go even more into a spiritual understanding as a self-actualized being. Can you talk about that?
Yes, of course. Now, so I think of that there's two purposes. You know, one is an internal purpose, and it's about self-actualizing. And then essentially, you know, the idea of dharma from, you know, the Vedas, this idea that we all have a purpose for being here and a purpose to fulfill. And that has nothing to do with any partner, any, you know, family member. It has much more to do with, you know, the human race and the universe. You know, that there's some purpose I have to fulfill to really impact this universe around me. And that's the external purpose. The internal purpose, I think, is this one of self-actualization, you know. And these relationships, I think, are what ultimately, you know, allow us to fulfill and be connected to that purpose, you know, that greater purpose, internal and external. Or sometimes it can be completely, you know, repeating bad or, you know, difficult relationships keep us off track. You know, they keep us in addiction. They keep us in depression. They keep us in, you know, in these difficult states of mind and suffering, essentially. Mm. You know, they keep, and when we're suffering, how much work are we thinking about, you know, on a bigger platform? Not a lot, you know?
Right. So this movement towards self-actualization and actually getting in touch with your dharma.
Yes.
I think we do all have a purpose. And I think when we do find our purpose, that is the most exciting thing that will drive us forward in the world. So how do we get in touch with that purpose?
Well, I think first of all, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it, you know, that I'm particularly passionate about? You know, many people, unfortunately, you know, give up on their dream. Their, you know, the dream that they had, oh, it's too late. I'm not this enough. I'm not that enough. Smart enough, rich enough, whatever.
Right.
So I often, you know, I ask people, you know, think about, let's just say if you had a family member that recently passed and they left you half of their estate, $50 million, right?
Okay.
Now, you know, what's the first thing that you would do if this happened? Now, you know, right? What's the first thing you would do, right? Some other questions to think about, you know, when you were a child, you know, growing up, what did you want to be, right? What were you dreaming of being? Now, keep in mind, I tell people, don't quit your day job while you're figuring this out. A lot of times, as you know and I know, and many people, we got to keep, you know, our day job, got to keep the bills paid while we're reconnecting with this passion and with this dream job, right? But, you know, reconnecting, what is it that they would do if there was no limitations, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Also, what are their natural talents, their signature strengths? You know, what comes easily to them? You know, for me, for example, you know, talking to people, connecting with people, taking some of these complex ideas and making them into bite-sized, digestible pieces, that comes naturally to me. So it serves me in this, you know, I get passionate about when I start talking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's an all it's in alignment with some of my natural signature strengths.
I see. No, that's go ahead. Yeah.
So you know, reconnecting with what comes naturally to us, not focusing on our weaknesses, rather focusing on our strengths, and then realizing that it's not too late. You can still somehow get involved with that particular, you know, mode of expression, that particular place one feels passionate, you know, and then to surround ourselves with those people, you know, so you and I, you know, having met and, you know, and surrounding ourselves with like-minded people, that vibration and that energy that we can then move with, we'll move them, it moves us, and essentially all of a sudden you feel more and more connected with that passion.
Right. No, I get that. So, I mean, your whole work seems to be about this self-awareness.
Yes.
What's really driving us in our relationships, in ourselves, in our way of being in the world. But then you also talk about living up to agreements you make with other people. Now, what if you make an agreement and something else comes along? Do you that maybe you would enjoy more than the agreement you made? Why? What's wrong with changing your agreement?
I mean, no, I would say nothing is wrong with
changing
it. The thing I actually particularly highlight there is breaking the agreement. Is like breaking it as in no show, no call, you know?
I see.
The person just doesn't show up, or they show up a half hour late.
So
what does
that mean then? How does that reflect on the person in your understanding?
Well, number one, it's not about me. It's about them.
Yeah.
You know? But many people, I tell you, and this is something that comes up every day, personalize it. Oh, well, you didn't show up or you didn't return my call. And it's something about me. No, somebody doesn't show up or they don't keep their appointment on time. That's about them. It doesn't mean that they're a bad person, you know, or a good person for that matter. It's just all it says is, oh, this person has difficulty keeping agreements.
But you talk about how it will, of course, it will affect relationships. But.
Of course, right, because think about it. You know, I mean, if somebody makes a plan with you, Alan, and then they show up late the first time, don't show up the second time, is there even a third time?
No, not for me.
Exactly. Exact same with me. There is no third time. And I think when we start getting more and more in alignment with our word, with our purpose, we start resonating at that level. We start resonating at this level of being a spiritual perfection with our human problems. Then, you know, we're getting more and more, and we start drawing people like this, you know, in our personal life. These become the people that are surrounding us.
Right. No, I get that. You know, going back to that idea of Dharma, what we're here to do, you know, people start to live their lives. And the quote you say, we're the center of a circle whose circumference is determined by our own self-imposed limitations.
Yes.
So is it possible that people could become so stuck that they think they're doing their Dharma when they're really stuck in their, comfort zone?
Well, if it's not particularly, satisfying and they're still feeling discontent, they might want to think about, is it really in alignment with their dharma, right? Because I think if we are in alignment with that, then we will actually feel very good about it. We will know internally. I think I can ask you, do you feel the work that you do with New Realities is in alignment with your life's purpose?
Well, you know, for me, there's no separation between what I do and what I am. And then for me, it's not even a purpose. It's just what I am.
So you've actually, you know, integrated these two things to the point that you don't even see a separation between those two anymore. This is who you've become. You've become your life's purpose.
Well, I've always been that, but now it's paying off in a way. I never knew what direction it would sort of take, but I was always incredibly curious about everything. So I figured, how can I take that curiosity and then share that with other people and sort of share it with the world? So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just happened somehow that...
But I would imagine along the way, there were times when you had doubt. There were times when you, you know, second-guessed, and then you had to go back, look at which parts of your story that came from. You probably did this very naturally without even realizing you were doing it.
Well, I did it. I mean, like my mother wanted me to go into my father's business, which was an awful business that killed him in a sense. He worked in steel construction. I couldn't think of a denser, more awful place to be than that. And, you know, well, I couldn't do that. That didn't feel good for me. So yeah, there were times, of course, you know, I mean, but I never felt like I doubted what I wanted. You know, I felt like I had to do what made me feel good to do, you know?
And well, you know, you just said something very key, Alan. You said it never felt good to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is so critical that it has to feel good. And, yes. You know, also keep in mind, you know, there's only one O, you know, the difference between good and God.
Right. You know? It's like, oh. But I, you know, it didn't feel good to sit behind a desk in an office in a cubicle looking at paper, although I, you know, I'm doing that now. I mean, I'm on my computer now, but it's like I'm creating my own sense of what I want, and
this is your starship, exactly.
Right,
you're the captain here.
I guess so. I mean, yeah. So, but thank you for helping me acknowledge that part of myself that I've never really thought about. I've just done what I've done, and you know, and I've met a lot of people and gone a lot of places, and that's all been really, really fun for me to do. So. And if other people benefit, I'm really happy about that. Like from this conversation, if people listening can benefit and learn something about themselves, and I've learned something, I've contributed, I fulfill my dharma, you fulfilled your purpose by sharing your knowledge, and everybody's happy.
That's it. And this felt good, and this feels good. And so I know it's along the right path. That's what tells us, you know. And usually when we're doing something that is not along our higher, you know, path for our higher self, usually there's that little voice that tells us, not a good idea, you know.
Right, and you've got to listen to that, yes.
Yes, got to listen really to those whispers, you know, to those subtle voices.
But the question is, there's the fear of the unknown. So, yes, how do you know if you're going off in a new direction, if it's telling you it doesn't feel good or it does feel good, if it's the unknown? You know what I mean? So it's like you have a chance to go into a whole new branch of your thing, and it doesn't feel good, but it doesn't feel bad, and there's some hesitation because we don't know what it will be. I mean, I'm just curious what your idea is, how you sense walking the unpaved path, you know?
Yes, I would say if at all possible, get a mentor. And it doesn't have to be somebody, you know, like like a psychiatrist or a therapist. It can be somebody you look up to, somebody doing something that you say, wow, I would like to be a part of that project, and get involved. Because you're absolutely correct. In the beginning, all of those self-doubts that are in the story, all of those rate-limiting steps, those places that plague us will come up.
Right.
And so if we're working and if we're around other people, we can share that. Somehow that supports, that positive, you know, that energy of that whole movement keeps us in that circle. You know, and we keep moving. And when we're struggling, we can ask for support. So have a mentor and don't be afraid to ask for help.
Well, that's good. That does help. But what if there is nobody around? I think what I guess is coming to me, we just have to trust in ourselves in a sense. We have to trust our inner voice to know what feels good and what doesn't.
That's right. And, you know, what feels good temporarily and what really feels good long term, you know, usually things that come quickly are not, they don't have a lot of longevity, and they usually are high risk. You know, we can get in the car, put the metal, you know, on the floor, go 100 miles an hour. That gives us this rush feeling, but it's very dangerous. You can end up dead. And you get out of the car and, you know, it goes away in 30 seconds, you know.
Right. So you're saying if there's something substantial, a future you're moving towards that feels good, then what? What are you saying?
What I'm saying is know that it takes time.
Oh, I see.
It's not going to be an overnight process.
I mean,
how long have you been working on new realities, right? I mean, this really, to do really something that is going to, be positive in that realm takes a lifetime's worth of work, you know?
Right. Right, right. It does. It does. Then it's each step along the way also has to be fulfilling, I would say.
That's right. That's right. And, even the word destiny, maybe a year ago, 6 months ago, I realized destiny and the word destination, you know, that there's obviously a lot in common. And
right.
We're always reaching new destinations. And we have to, again, develop this level of self-awareness of the mind. And slowly we end up where? At our final destiny, our destination, our destiny.
Right. So you're a doctor, right? You're an MD.
Yes.
So you're a psychiatrist, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And so you also, that you're dealing with people, but I mean, you're coming from a spiritual approach, but you must deal with people who don't have this awareness. And do you believe in medicating those people? How do you deal with your patients, not just from this level, but you have this very aware perspective? How do you deal with the other half of those people out there?
Right. I mean, listen, many times people come in and really it's, okay, fix me and fix this problem. You know, they want that very...
How do you... there is no pill for fixing psychological conditions.
Exactly. I mean, if somebody has a bad marriage, you know, there is no pill that is necessarily going to fix that. Now, with that being said, right, now there are some people who really do have a genetic predisposition, say, for a major depressive problem. Now, when these people get depressed, they get not a little depressed. They don't get just blue or they don't just call out of work. They start thinking about hanging themselves in the garage. So that, you know, that type of severity, we, you know, clearly know that, again, chemicals in the brain are involved and that we do have, you know, certain medications that we can use as tools. Now, does that mean we should be throwing 6, 8, 10 medications at somebody? No, bad medicine. And in fact, anybody listening, if you know, if you're in any kind of psychiatric, you know, if you're on a psychiatric medication, if you're on more than 3 medication, tell your doctor you want to get, you know, you want to really take another look at that. Because after 3 medication, you know, what is doing what? God only knows. There's 100 billion brain cells in our brain, each one making 10,000 connections with the next one.
So you're saying, though, that person has to be on medication for, if their tendency is towards depression, they have to be on that medication for the rest of their lives? Isn't there a way of working with them just with some of the stuff that you've been talking about here?
Yes. So initially what I would do is I would initially work with them exactly with what I'm talking about. So that psychological piece, we would also incorporate, you know, traditional Chinese medicine, maybe some herbs, maybe some acupuncture, exercise, meditation, yoga. And so, you know, we have to treat the mind, body, and spirit. So, but what I'm saying is with certain individuals, you know, they really have a high genetic load. And in those individuals, we do need to be more mindful that this person actually, like I have a young man I'm working with right now, and he came in today and he was having auditory hallucinations, you know, just on Sunday night, you know, and he's not doing any drugs. And you know, could there be some psychological piece that makes him more stressed and then therefore more symptomatic? Yes. But clearly there is a biological piece there, you know, that we have to manage as well.
Well, let me ask you something. If we're getting into the spiritual realm and hearing voices, let's say, there's a lot of people who are opening up to that realm and they're actually channeling these voices that seem to be coming from outside their consciousness. Could it be possible? I mean, how do you know the difference that someone's either having an hallucination or they're actually accessing another level of consciousness?
You know, I'll tell you the truth of that, Matt, the answer there, Alan, is I don't know.
Well,
I don't know if it really, I mean, like, so this is our current scientific, quote unquote, understanding of it. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the real, you know, basis of auditory hallucinations? You know, we have some theories about, you know, some of these chemicals, the dopamine and the particular pathway, and that these cause the positive symptoms. But these are really still on many levels, you know, theories.
But and I appreciate you say you don't know, because that's a very honest place. But I would think if there's not other – if this guy is just having a ordinary auditory hallucinations and the rest of his life seems to be working okay, then perhaps he is tapping into some other realm. If his behavior is weird or off or antisocial, then – I would say that's more a psychosis. That's just my understanding.
Yeah, no. I think you're absolutely right on there. Yeah, I mean, if it's an isolated, and usually we don't see auditory hallucinations in an isolated way, you know, usually in a psychiatric office. Mm-hmm. No, he has a lot of these other, you know, other aspects going on as well, you know, and he's depressed. He isolates a lot, gets very anxious. I mean, so there's a number of problems going on there.
I see. So that would... you never met anyone who just has the auditory hallucination and is fine? Of course, the auditory hallucinations could be disturbing enough, but is it possible, or have you ever seen it where someone?
I would surely open up to the idea of, you know, is this somehow some type of a channeling happen? Is he picking up on somebody else's, you know, a vibratory energy, and this is somehow getting translated into, you know, some kind of a auditory, you know, process. Again, answer it very honestly. I don't know, but I'm open to those possibilities.
But have you seen it in your practice for any at all? I'm just curious.
Have I seen somebody coming in more with just that kind of isolated?
Yes.
No. I would say in my practice, I have not.
Okay.
Keep in mind, a lot of times by the time people, you know, go to see the psychiatrist, and this goes really to speak of the stigma that exists, you know, usually at that level, if somebody just has maybe some auditory hallucinations going on, they probably are not, you know, suffering too great of an extent there. Unless, of course, they're hearing a voice telling them they'll kill themselves or hurt somebody. Those types of, you know, messages can be very anxiety provoking and uncomfortable.
I just think it's a really interesting crossroads we're at in psychology and psychiatry, where there are people experience phenomena that is greater than what the paradigm has said we are. And I'm just curious of how psychiatry integrates those possibilities. I mean, it's another level of conversation, but I'm curious because you're an open spiritual person. Obviously, you know where our consciousness is non-local, and there are other perhaps higher beings that are here that could communicate. Because,
you know, it reminds me, as you're saying that, I'll tell you a little bit of an odd experience. And I say odd because it was a new experience really to me. And it was really going back a few years ago, and it was on a winter day. And I was in my apartment, and I was writing, I was working on the book, and I was taking a break, and I felt this kind of message coming through me, and I just said, okay, Raj, just let go, just speak out loud. And I went with it, and I'll tell you, I was starting to say certain things that just didn't necessarily feel that they were coming from me, and they were insightful types of things, you know. And And this whole idea of channeling, you know, and I had been thinking about that. And so, you know,
well, I'd say you were opening up to another level of yourself. You were transcending the personality ego and actually accessing this higher level of consciousness.
That's right. I would, in theory, think that that's the direction.
No, I would say trust that, Raj, because we need to get out of this. Because I think the psychological paradigm, although it's helped many people, has also imprisoned many people.
Yes.
And enslaved them to a way of thinking that isn't necessarily helpful or true. That's just my feeling. And I think things like channeling or near-death experiences or telepathy, you could say those people are hallucinating, or you can say maybe there's something going on here that we need to expand. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. In fact, I think over the next 10, 15, 20 years, you know, we're really, and this is the exciting part of the mind right now. There's so much that now is, you know, getting more and more, you know, unfolding as we're moving forward. And there is a lot we don't understand yet. You're absolutely right. And in fact, you know, we need to be open to these non-traditional ways of thinking. And in any time, in fact, I tell people all the time, always leave room in your theory that you could be wrong. You know?
Yes.
Because that's that creative place in our mind that always was working and thinking and, you know, putting things together in different ways, that if we say, no, this is the way it is for sure, boom, that story is closed, you know?
Yes. No, I think that's good. And I think it'd be great if you could remind your colleagues in the psychiatry field that that's possible, because they have created a very limited box to put people in. And
unfortunately, you know, you're right. Yeah. Unfortunately, and many, you know, it's gone to, you know, the average HMO visit is 8 minutes long now. You know, I'm talking about your story. 8 minutes, that's not going to give you much time, you know?
That's how long people see a psychiatrist for, you're saying?
Can you imagine the average HMO insurance-driven visit now?
To a psychiatrist.
For physicians across the board is 8 minutes long. For psychiatry, it's a little bit longer. It's in that 10 to 12, 13 minute range. But still, that's not very long, you know? And it's a huge disservice. I think it's a huge disservice to the field.
Why do HMOs even exist? It seems like such a corrupt sort of a system.
No, the whole system obviously is currently broken at best, and you know what we're going to see what happens come January. I think that even many of us in the medical field don't really exactly know what changes are coming down the pipeline here.
What's supposed to happen in January?
No, I mean, this is when, you know, the whole Obamacare comes into place that's when all those rules start getting applied. And I'm hoping it creates some positive change. And listen, I'll tell you what, it's got to be better than what's been happening over the last, you know, few decades, you know, which really has been about money. You know, it's really been financially driven.
So what does Obamacare say? Because, I mean, I know it's a different conversation, but can you just tell me, because I haven't been following it.
You know what? I'll tell you, even as a physician, it's quite confusing to understand. And in fact, I just signed up to go to this workshop just to go understand it a little deeper. And it's in essence, I mean, what they're going to require now is that everybody have health insurance, right? So everybody's going to be required to have health insurance. And then, of course, you're going to have the very low socioeconomic group that can't afford it whatsoever, they'll be covered. I think the particular area that's going to be challenging is going to be that middle group where, you know, somebody makes $30,000 a year. And, you know, for New Yorkers, that's obviously, you know, the New York, they make about an average of $70,000, I believe, a year. But most of America, you know, it's between $30,000 and $40,000. And, you know, take home is what, a couple thousand bucks a month, $2,500 a month at that? And these insurance policies can cost $2,000 a month alone.
So why doesn't the government just take care of those people too, of everyone in a way?
Well, then a lot of people are saying this. We need to go to a single payer system where everybody gets the same coverage and you get rid of these HMOs altogether.
Yeah, why can't they get rid of those HMOs?
Listen, I tell you, I'll be the first to welcome a radical change, even though, you know, ultimately, you know, if I have to find a new line of work, you know, I'm saying from a financial direction, I would happily do that if we can get good coverage for really all of America, you know.
Why would you have to find a new line of work, though?
No, no, I'm saying, for example, you know, I'm, well, to be, yeah, even doing this work, you know, even building this vision, you know, it is taking, obviously, the resources that have to go in. Now, I'm saying, you know, a lot of the more, my understanding right now of systems where they do have more of a single payer system, those in those countries, you know, physicians, you know, are not really financially making all that much more than, you know, let's say, you know, a different, you know, more of a less skilled job, so to speak. Now, that's okay with me. You know what I mean? I would still keep my hands in medicine, but I would also, again, if I, you know, needed to do something more, I would do something more, again, to stay connected with my purpose. That's where I was going with that.
I get that. So what ultimately, just to sort of wrap up, what is your vision for the planet, let's say for your work? I mean, what do you really want people to get?
I really want people to get that their story has nothing to do with their self-worth, that they are more than their story. I am more than my story. You are more than your story. And just because our story has been the way it has been up to this point, it doesn't mean it has to end that way. You are more than that.
I get it. You are more than that. That is the title of my guest's book, Dr. Raj Juneja. And where are you located mostly?
I'm both in New York and New Jersey. If anyone has any questions, they can email me at thedrraj@gmail.com, thedrraj at gmail.com. And the website is the same thing, thedrraj.com.
And you also do a radio program where you said you were going to interview me.
That's right. I'm looking forward to that. My publisher is Hay House Publishing, and they have, you know, weekly radio. Well, they have actually a number of authors, but I'm on Thursdays at 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. East Coast time at HayHouseRadio.com. HayHouseRadio.com every Thursday, 2 to 3 live.
Oh, so when should we do that interview? When are you free to do?
How about the first Thursday of July? Because the June schedule is already in.
The first Thursday of July is July 4th.
You know what? Let's be, because I'm not 100% sure if they're actually going to be operating that day because it's a holiday. Let's say July 11th. How about that?
I'll put that in my schedule and people can listen who are listening now to that. So it's on, what's the radio station?
Hay House Radio, HayHouseRadio, HayHouseRadio.com. And that will be Thursday, July the 11th, 2 p.m. East Coast time.
Okay. And it's an hour show?
Yeah, it's an hour show with a five-minute break in between.
All right. Because I think psychiatry is a big part of new realities, of understanding new reality. But I think we have, like I was saying, transcend that as well with
yes.
this idea of what you're talking about, this awareness that we are spiritual beings, you know, and
that's right, and reconnecting with that,
yeah, and through awareness, yes, and
through awareness and being gentle with ourselves, you know, Rick, you know, saying, you know what, it's okay, we're gonna make mistakes, you know, but the whole idea is to either go through it or grow through it, you know.
wait, I just want to absorb that, being gentle with ourselves, that's a really key point, I think, in understanding
yes.
and having compassion for our own process.
That's right. Because, you know, that's probably the most important relationship, Alan, is the one with ourself.
Whoever the self is, right?
That's right. Both with that human self and with that spiritual self.
Which, I mean, the human self is really just an aspect of that greater self. And I think we're moving into a culture, and this is really what I like to do with new realities, that talk about that broad awareness. We're moving into a culture where that will be recognized.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. I think people are very curious. They're realizing that, you know, sometimes, you know, what we think we know isn't everything we know. Listen, you know, remember, it took like 40 years, four decades for people to finally accept that the world was not flat, even after they found out.
Yes, and that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. And,
That's right. So we have to be open to the idea that, you know, there's things that we don't know and that we still need to understand.
Well, that's where I come in. You know, that's what we could talk about, those avenues of the mystery.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm sure my listeners will love it.
Because we are ultimately the mystery. We're not anything that psychiatry or medicine or anything can be explained. There's too many miracles that happen, and we need to acknowledge that part as well.
And I love that, and I really appreciate you saying that, because that's something new for me to think about, which is that you're absolutely right, that there is just an unknown piece to this, and it is mysterious.
Well,
can we sit with that?
Yes, read Anita Moonjani. You know her book, A Dying
yes.
to Be Me? Have you
yes.
read the book?
Yes, very powerful.
Yes, isn't that great? Well, that is just like, oh my God, that thread, all bets are off with that. With that kind of amazing work. So
that's right. And you know, what she talks about is really this idea that if, you know, once she dropped her story,
exactly,
she realized the unlimited being that she was.
Exactly. If we could realize that without having to die to be me, to be who you are, then we can really move into a new world that will be an incredible gift for everyone. So.
That's right. That's when this God consciousness can start really expressing through our conscious lives.
Exactly. So I did a great interview with her, and she's holding the vision for a new paradigm, and it's very exciting. And I'm glad you're doing what you're doing.
I'm glad to be a part of it.
Okay. So thank you, Dr. Raj, as you're called. Is that what your radio is called, Dr.
yeah.
Raj?
Yeah, yep, that's it. The name of the show is Head Up with Dr. Raj. Yeah.
Head Up with Dr. Raj?
Head Up with Dr. Raj.
I mean, one more question. Do you
yes.
ever feel, I guess you do, with some psychiatrists, like you said, they overprescribe, but can you ever go in there and say to your colleagues, why are you doing that? Why are you giving that person so many medications when obviously it's not working or helpful?
I absolutely do. I often call and say, listen, this person's coming in with all of this medication. I go, you know, what was your thought process behind it? And, you know, you have to be careful, and you have to word it, you know, nicely. Otherwise, people just get defensive and they don't really want to deal with
but
it.
But they're
you know?
Hurting people.
Well, you know what it is? It's this quick fix. Many, you know, listen, and physicians are part of the problem. I think there's some wonderful, excellent, aware physicians, and then there are other people that are not so aware, you know, and maybe hooked into the money more. And it's like anything else, you know. It's
well,
not
that's
just
awful. Doctors. They're giving people medications because they want the money. That's like criminal, you know.
Well, it is criminal.
That is awful.
It's really an extension of white collar crime.
You know what I mean? But it's not just white collar; they're actually harming people in the process.
Well, think about what happened with Wall Street and how many people that harmed. You know, I mean, I agree with you. They're certainly harming people in the process. I mean, believe it or not,
them emotionally, psychologically. I mean, they're damaging people to make money. That is even worse than Wall Street, I think, because at least, you know, that's just money. These are people's, you know, whole thought processes they're messing with.
Well, I tell you, one of the most alarming things I ever heard a physician say was, you know, well, if they get addicted, that's their problem. And I almost, my jaw almost dropped to the floor.
You should turn that guy in. You should.
And I was like, are you serious in that statement? You know what I mean? It's their problem. You know what I mean?
He's just getting him addicted drugs. So I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly. I mean, a lot of the medications are habit forming. So we have to be also, from a consumer point of view, just for your listeners, again, they need to ask, hey, are these medications addictive?
Yeah.
It's a very simple question to ask. And I surely would ask that anytime a new medication is being prescribed. If they're at the dentist and they're getting their tooth pulled,
more than likely, you know, some Advil will be enough. You know, and then even if they are going to get some pain medications, you know, and the doctor starts writing you 90, you say, no, I need like 10, you know?
Right.
Don't give me 90.
Well, that's about people taking responsibility for their lives. But no, I'm happy you're out there doing your part in a very moral and beautiful way in helping people, you know, just take care, better care of themselves. So
I appreciate that, and it's a nice reminder, and I appreciate that acknowledgement.
No, it's important. I think it's important in the field. You should be part of a psychiatry over panel checking in on these kinds of
things. We're working on, you know, I mean, on the public, I'm the chair for the Public Education Committee in New Jersey for the APA as well. And so, no, I love this public education piece. And again, if anybody has any questions or they want me to come out and do some kind of a presentation on self-awareness, please contact me at thedrraj@gmail.com. We can happily make arrangements. And again, you know, it's not about the money. You know, I work with people and organizations where they can't afford, you know, a lot of finances towards it. Again, that's not the primary drive for me. Mm-hmm. Going back to purpose, I have always found this, that when we follow our purpose, money follows us.
Right. Thank you for that reminder. Yes.
That's it.
Thank you, Dr. Raj. Okay.
Thank you, Alan, so much. Talk to you soon.
Yes. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I've been talking to Dr. Raj Juneja, and you can get his book, which is, I just set this up here. Raj, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, your book, You Are More Than That, by Hay House.
You Are More Than That. It's on at hayhouse.com. It's also on Amazon. It's also on barnesandnoble.com. You can get it at your local bookstore as well.
Right. Okay. Thanks a lot. And I'll just sign out by saying Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, you can go to my website, newrealities.com, and you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening. Good night.